KALW.
There was a patient there who never really spoke. Her decline in terms of dementia really progressed.
A Bay Area nonprofit is bringing laughter to hospitals and assisted living centers through clowns.
The staff, they were so surprised because they had never seen her smile before.
We'll hear why clowning is essential. Then Roman Mars, the host of 99% Invisible, talks about how he got his start in radio.
I just tried to knock on every door until someone gave me some kind of job. The only people who opened the door was KALW.
And we look at some of the hidden designs found right here in Oakland.
It's really not the big buildings that do it as much for me as the street level experience.
That's coming up. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. Today, we're starting with a story from our series, At Work, looking at how COVID has changed our jobs.
I have a lot of pride in my work.
How do you do it?
Sprays, masks, gloves.
I'm with the swamp team.
Hi, my friends, and how are you?
It's nice now with technology.
Pandora's box has been opened.
It's a beautiful way to make your living, but it's more work than I ever imagined.
What do you get when a clown, a clinical psychologist, and a patient walk into a hospital? Well, you get something called the Medical Clown Project. This Bay Area nonprofit sends clowns to hospitals, emergency rooms, and retirement homes. But these aren't normal clowns, they're medical clowns. 10 years ago, a clinical psychologist and her husband, a clown, were inspired by a growing field of research. It showed that medical clowning interventions improved patient outcomes, so they started the Medical Clown Project. Before COVID, they sent clowns to emergency rooms, pediatric wards, and assisted living locations. And while the shelter-in-place order has changed how they work, it certainly hasn't stopped them. KALW's Azul Dahlstrom-Ekman spoke with one of them to learn what it's like to spend a day in their clown shoes.
My name is Calvin Kai Koo, and I work with the Medical Clown Project as the Executive Artistic Director. Let's go on a roller coaster. All right. We're going to the top. When I was in college, I was studying computer engineering, and I just wasn't happy in that field and decided to make a pivot to theater. I got inspired by one of my teachers who brought clowning to the college. It's really high up here. And from that, I was hooked. I went to the Clown Conservatory right after that and got to spend a year studying clowning. Oh boy. When I was asked if I could use my clowning skills to help people with their needs and to lift up their spirits, I knew right away that that's something I had to do. My mom was a nurse, and it was a little bit like an homage to her to be like, hey, I want to get into healthcare too, and this is my own special way. So if we were to go into a room, we get a briefing of what's going on with each patient. Medically, we get some information, or even psychologically, how they're feeling. So then we can go in with that into that space knowingly and prescribing a certain healthcare clowning intervention. Whether it's, oh, this person needs to relax, this person is in a lot of pain. Probably moving around is not good for this person. So let's play this nice ukulele song to make them just want to escape into this peaceful, peaceful world of white sandy beaches, palm trees, blue skies, a nice breeze on their face. This is the island sounds. I remember a time when we were visiting a unit. It was a memory care unit. And there was a patient there who never really spoke. Her decline in terms of dementia just really progressed. we're doing our show and you can just hear her walker just kind of scraping on the floor as she's going, and she arrives into the space, and then we get down on our knees and we go, "The queen is here! Oh, our glorious, glorious queen!" And we gently put our hand on her shoulder, and we got in close, and we said, "Our queen, we love you, our queen." And at that moment, the staff, they were so surprised because they had never seen her smile before. When we have those experiences, we know that the work that we're doing is so effective.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars.
Right now, there's actually a lot of studies on healthcare clowning and the benefits. A lot of the research that has been done is mostly through the dream doctors in Israel. They had a group that did not have clowning and one that did have clowning. And it was remarkable to see the results, that those who had clowning felt so much more comfortable going into surgery than those who did not. About a year ago, we started having our healthcare clowning interventions charted on the patient's charts, which has been really, really cool, because that then hopefully leads to some additional research that may lead to the integration of this work.
Oh yeah, you're right. We should give everyone a high five. Okay, is everyone ready? All you have to do is put your hands up like this.
Since shelter in place, we have stopped going in person. So we started with San Francisco Campus for Jewish Living to create a virtual experience with their residents.
We need to warm up our hands before we do a high five. Okay, here we go.
As the weeks went on, an amazing thing started happening. The residents started getting excited about it.
Now it's time for the great high five greeting to all of you out there. I'm so excited. Okay, here he goes. A one and a two and a three.
There are always going to be patients who are going to be in isolation, who are going to be quarantined for whatever illness they may have, and we can now reach them. We don't have to leave them out. So this whole experience has inspired us to expand our program and become more inclusive and accessible to others. After we had finished a shift and we were just checking in with each of the residents, one of the residents started talking about how much she was so thankful about being able to smile and being able to laugh.
Oh, there's a song that says,
"Yes,
you're smiling.
Thank you,
smiling. The whole world smiles with
That's
you.
That's right. The whole world
when you're
smiles.
Laughing, when you're laughing, the whole world laughs with you.
Oh, when you're smiling."
I believe healthcare clowning and the practice of joy is essential right now, especially. And we need to know how to get to the light, the joy, the laughter, the fun, the playfulness, the levity, the buoyancy, the resilience. That's why our work and this work is essential.
And I hope.
That story was produced by KELW's Azul Dahlstrom Ekman. You can find more about the Medical Clown Project at KELW.org. And tune into Cross Currents tomorrow at 5 for the next story from our At Work series.
A lot of people thought, oh, you know, I can get by with working like this for a few weeks. And it's been 9 months that they've been sitting at their kitchen counter or working on their couch. It's like all of a sudden their back is just like in a spasm, or they're just starting to get chronic, you know, like repetitive issues from it.
We'll meet a chiropractor tomorrow at 5.
Thank you.
You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hannah Baba. A little over 10 years ago, Roman Mars first produced his hit podcast 99% Invisible from his bedroom. The show tells the stories behind design and architecture that we don't tend to notice, whether it's a mailbox or a skyscraper built decades ago. 99% Invisible started as an idea right here at KALW, where Roman was volunteering to learn audio production. 400 million downloads later, today it's one of the most popular podcasts. Now Roman is telling some of these stories off the mic and on the page. His new book is called The 99% Invisible City, a field guide to the hidden world of everyday design, and it's a New York Times bestseller. KALW's Janae Darden sat down with Roman Mars, who back in the day also worked on this show, Cross Currents.
So Roman, when did you get the radio bug?
I got the radio bug in the 90s. I was like studying plant genetics. I was a graduate student, and I listened to public radio all the time. It was my only form of entertainment. I couldn't afford a television. I couldn't afford really anything. And I just loved the way people talked on public radio. I loved the storytelling. I was obsessed with it. And at some point, I realized that if I could study a new thing every day, the way people seem to do on public radio, like read a new book, think about a new thing, talk to a new person, that would be the perfect life. And that was the radio bug. I just knew that there was a job there. I didn't know what that job was. I didn't know what it was called. And I just tried to knock on every door until someone gave me some kind of job to learn how to do it.
Was that door KALW?
Yeah, that door, the only people who opened the door was KALW. And it was a godsend. I mean, it really was amazing. And at the time, you know, because it was this sort of fallow ground that had, you know, so much potential, I was able to work on, create shows. I worked on every type of show. I was an engineer. I fixed the ISDN. I ran the board. I filled in on Morning Edition. I did every type of job that was available at KALW to learn how to do radio. And they gave so much to me into what I am today is because of KALW.
You know, a lot of people right now, they're rethinking their life. You know, we're in quarantine, things have shut down. And you went from grad school to, I know you worked at a startup, to working at KALW. Was there any fear about changing careers?
I came from pretty humble beginnings, and I always knew I could sort of get by on whatever I could do, whatever I could make do on. And so I rented a room in someone's house at the time, the way I was able to afford, you know, being a volunteer at KALW. And so I had a ton of fear and a ton of doubt, but I just have always found that taking the most interesting path and trying to do really what you want to do in life, it pays off. It's worth it. Even if you don't achieve it exactly the way you think you're going to, the process of figuring that stuff out is still worth it. And so,
congratulations, 10 years on the show.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks. You ever think it would evolve to what it has today?
No, because honestly, you know, it was a 4.5-minute segment that ran in the C block of Morning Edition. That's how it started on KALW. I didn't really envision it as a podcast at all, even at the very beginning. You know, being a podcast at the time meant something very different than it does today. I mean, like, there was no business around podcasting. There was no industry around podcasting. So, but I did make the show with longevity in mind.
10 years, the show has evolved, and I imagine you have evolved.
Yeah.
Also, as you being more famous now. I mean, I know, I'm sure paparazzi isn't following you down the street.
Not really, no.
But, you know, you have so many followers.
Yeah,
people know who you are. How does that affect you, you know?
I can walk down the streets of Berkeley and Oakland unmolested. You know, like, it is not really an issue for me. So fame doesn't intersect with my life very much. But you just can get more done in a way. Like, there's a real privilege to things. So, like, when I was, you know, going to sell a book, you know, I had this platform. I had this show that I could present it to. I had people who would want to buy it. And because of that, all these big companies want to meet with you and talk to you. And, you know, I mean, they're not bad people or anything like this, but they just don't, it's not about the quality. It's not about like you doing something, some great piece of art. It's because you have a platform and you can sell it, and they know that. And mm-hmm. And so that's what that gets you, is opportunity. But the main thing is having an audience who cares. There's plenty of people that are more famous than I am that still can't, you know, get people to maybe support their art or buy a book or something like that. But like over time, you know, we built this through a kind of public radio mindset and a public radio model that people were a part of the process of building the show and felt like they, you know, contributed because they truly did. Like there was an existential point, you know, when I did the first Kickstarter and KLW kind of gave it to me to be independent and raise money on it, that they took it and made it important. And if it wasn't for the audience making it important, we would not exist today.
So let's talk about the book.
Okay.
What did you like about storytelling through a book? Or did you like it?
I didn't like it. It was hard. I didn't like it as much.
really?
No. I mean, so since the show started, I've been propositioned to do a book, but I never felt like there was a real need. And there was a turning point where I felt there was a need. And that was, one is it allowed me to tell a few different stories that were kind of complicated and visual that you just can't do on the radio or in a podcast quite the same way. So it allows you like a few more options. And the other one was, you know, I've done 415 episodes of this show. As much as audio is the most superior form of storytelling and communication that there is in the world for all time.
Ooh, I know some people that would disagree with that. I agree with you, but I know some people that would be like,
well, they are wrong. So audio is perfect. As much as I love it, it is kind of locked in to this linear, rather non-searchable format. Like it's there to be experienced. And it's not there to be archived as much, and it's not there to be re-experienced very well. Like, say, for example, you came across a curb cut, and you're like, I remember there was a 99% Invisible episode about it. What was it called? And you could search the website, and the website is functional, but then you have to listen to the whole 30-minute show about it to get the full story. And it was just like all this information was locked into this one format, and I wanted to break it apart and have it available to people to like search and peruse, and like if they needed to find that one name, they could find it. And so the show is about design. I'm a big believer in purposeful, intentional design. And there was a reason for the book to exist besides just have it be, you know, like a merchandising extension of the podcast.
You know, when I was in journalism school, I used to hear everybody has a story. And I feel like with this book and with your show, everything.
Yeah, every story. In my response to that, because I hear that every person has a story, is not everyone knows how to tell their story. And that takes time and skill to do. And when you're telling the story of objects, it's even more so. You know, you have to pick the right thing and decide what you're going to do. I mean, there's the book is not a collection of origin stories for these objects. It's not like the origin of the traffic light or the origin of a, you know, manhole cover. It's really, we try to tell the most interesting story of the thing that exists in the world. And it could be anywhere in the world. And the idea is that the things around you spur this, you know, like this curiosity about the most interesting version of that thing around you and why it is the way it is, you know, where you are in this moment. So
you close out your show saying that you're in beautiful downtown Oakland. What's your favorite architecture and design in Oakland?
Well, I love the Tribune Tower, which is right across the street from the office. I love the neon clock face. I think it's beautiful. I think it's this great icon and beacon in the city. But it's really not the big buildings that do it as much for me as the street level experience. And so, like, I love Chinatown. I love the smells of Chinatown. I like that scramble walk that's right there where it's a crisscross walk and it's beautiful and has this ornate painting on the street.
Yeah. All right, so 10 years is your anniversary. Where will Roman Mars be 10 years from now?
Oh, my God. Retired is what I hope. Like, I've worked pretty much a full-time job since I was 14 years old. Like, I am so tired. My goal in the next 10 years is to develop experiencing the world not mediated through my need to produce content related to me experiencing the world. And it's sort of like a meta existential question, but I really want to just enjoy things because like I've been a professional appreciator of things and I want to be an amateur appreciator of things.
That was podcast host and author Roman Mars speaking with KALW's Janae Darden. His book is The 99% Invisible City, a field guide to the hidden world of everyday design. And so now we're going to go to Roman's studios in beautiful downtown Oakland, as he says, to get a peek at some of the hidden designs right here in our backyard. Here's 99% Invisible producer Kurt Kohlstedt.
So right next door to our office, there's a storefront. And the businesses inside it of there have changed over the years. But out front, there's this persistent element, and it's a planter. And the planter is kind of recessed into the facade a bit, so the edge of it, the front edge of it, is up against the sidewalk. And the plants and dirt are held in place by this low retaining wall that's maybe a couple inches deep. And, you know, under the best of circumstances, it wouldn't be a great place to sit, although I've seen people try. But what makes it really, really unappealing is this row of knobs that they have arrayed along the top of the wall. And we've talked about things like spikes on the show before that dissuade people from sitting. But these knobs, they look almost decorative. Like, they're painted black to blend in with the black wall. They're defensive design, but, like, in disguise. And when we think about things like defensive design or hostile architecture, we tend to imagine obvious things like spikes. But there are a lot of less obvious ones, too. Some places have sprinkler systems that are situated to keep people away rather than to, you know, actually water plants. And in Seattle, there's this one bike rack in particular that's kind of infamous because people started to question, you know, why did somebody put a bike rack there? That's not a place people would normally park their bikes. And it turned out that this was put there by the city to keep people from setting up tents and camping on that particular stretch of sidewalk. And, you know, big picture, a lot of these interventions, they don't tackle bigger underlying issues. They just kind of shuffle people around. And to me, that's a good argument for transparency, among other things. Because when you disguise something, you stop conversations from starting around it, right? So once it's clear why something is the way it is, people can start to debate whether or not a given design quote-unquote solution is humane or equitable or even effective.
That was 99% Invisible producer Kurt Kohlstedt. You can catch the show on your favorite podcast player. And before we leave you, here's some new music from a local artist. This band is Flamingo Bay. They're performing for a live stream event with the Art House Gallery this Saturday. Today's Cross Currents team includes Carla Estevez, Ren Farrell, Lisa Morehouse, and Marissa Ortega Welch. Our engineers are James Rollins and Gabe Graben. Production manager is Shirin Adil. Managing editor is David Boyer. News director is Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.